Hello, I'm Claire Armistead, and welcome to the Guardian's Haycast. Once again, we'll be bringing you daily podcasts with features, interviews, the choice bits from live events. So for those of you who can't make it, don't panic, we've got it covered. Today, we'll be hearing from two of the top bookings at the festival, best-selling novelist Sarah Waters and the Nobel Peace Prize winner Desmond Tutu. Plus, of course, our very own John Crace will be out and about poking fun at the masses and the speakers, not to mention the organisers and, of course, me. But first, Charlotte Higgins, our Hay Diarist, is with me, sitting out on the lawn, which is not something we were able to do much of last year, is it, Charlotte?
It makes such a difference, doesn't it? And, you know, last year, well, I hardly took my boots off for the whole time that I was here. So the idea that there might be some sunshine is really good.
So down to business, Charlotte, what are the highlights?
Well, for me, great Hay Festival events fall into two categories, really. There are the people who are wonderful performers, and of course not all writers happen to be great performers, but if you've got someone like Alan Bennett, who's coming this year, or Stephen Fry, or Tony Curtis, the great Hollywood legend, then you just know you're going to have a great time. And then there are other people who are just giant figures, so the idea of seeing Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, talking about Dostoevsky with A.N. Wilson, I think sounds fabulous. And people like Eric Hobsbawm, the nonagenarian Marxist historian who's lived through so much of history and is a great mind. Really looking forward to that.
I always really like the science events. Some of the Hay rock stars are actually scientists, aren't they? Very serious people, like Steve Jones is going to be talking about Darwinism. And Martin Rees, the astronomer royal, who's actually going to be talking about things like extraterrestrials and what the world is going to be like in 2050.
That's right. And I also have my little enthusiasm. So because I'm a classics nut, I'm really looking forward to a couple of Roman-themed events. So Adrian Goldsworthy is talking about his book about the late Roman Empire, and then Caroline Lawrence, who writes brilliant children's books about ancient Rome, Roman mysteries. I'm really looking forward to that too.
So it's a festival for enthusiasms and quirks as well as the mainstream stuff.
My name's Giles Foden and you're listening to the Guardian Haycast. Which literary character would I associate myself with? Well, much to the amusement of my friends, my answer to that is going to be Don Juan. In particular, Molière's version of him. I first read Molière's play, Don Juan, as a young boy at school, and what appealed to me about that character was that he refused boundaries. He was always pushing at every social limit, and that's something that I think writing should do. So, much to the amusement of my chums, yes, Don Juan.
Well, I'm joined now by Sarah Waters, one of Hay's star attractions this year. Her fifth novel, The Little Stranger, is an absolutely terrifying ghost story set in rural Warwickshire just after the Second World War. Now, Sarah, this is a bit of a departure for you, isn't it?
Well, it is and it isn't, you know. I mean, it's very much, The Little Stranger very much grew out of the work I did for The Night Watch, my last book, which was set during the Second World War.
In London.
In London, yes. So, you know, having told 140 story and wanting, still interested in the period, and wanting to tell a very different sort of story. So I thought I moved completely to the post-war period. The action takes place 47 to 48. And I moved, out of London for the first time to Warwickshire. And I moved to a novel of the supernatural, which is a new thing for me in a sense, but I think all my novels have their gothic moments, and certainly a novel like Affinity, my second book, is pretty spooky at times. So for me, it felt like quite a natural move, actually.
Before you go any further, let's have a little bit of a reading so we can see for ourselves what the atmosphere of this novel is like.
Yeah, sure. This comes from about a third of the way through the novel, and the narrator is Dr. Faraday, a rural country doctor, and he's just heard a story from Roderick Ayres, the son out at Hundreds Hall, who's telling him he's had this rather extraordinary experience, which is our first account in the novel, really, of something definitely supernatural having happened at the house. There have been many times in my medical career when, on examining a patient or on seeing the result of some test or other, it has gradually but ineluctably broken upon me that the case before me is a desperate one. I can think, for example, of a young married woman just pregnant who came to see me with a summer cough. I remember very vividly setting the stethoscope to her breast and hearing the first faint but devastating indications of tuberculosis. I can recall a handsome, talented boy brought to me with growing pains, actually the onset of a muscle-wasting illness, which within 5 years was to take his life. The thickening tumour, the spreading cancer, the clouding eye. They're part of a family doctor's caseload alongside the rashes and the sprains, but I've never got used to them, never caught my first certain glimpse of them without the heaviest feeling of impotence and dismay. Something like that dismay began to creep upon me as I sat listening to Rod tell his extraordinary story. How long it took him, I'm not sure, for he spoke with a certain brokenness, a hesitation and reluctance, a shrinking from the ghastliness of the details of the tale. I kept silent for the most part, and when he'd finished, we sat together in that quiet room, and I glanced about me at the safe, familiar, fathomable world, the stove, the counter, the instruments and jars, old Dr. Gill's hand on their faded labels, and seemed to see it all grown slightly strange to me, all knocked slightly askew.
So the world grown slightly strange. It seems to me that that phrase sums up so much what ghost stories are about.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think I was even conscious of that as I wrote the phrase. It seemed right to me too. And certainly, you know, when I was working on The Little Stranger, I read a lot of ghost stories. I've always been a big fan of ghost stories. And I did find that the best ones were ones, say, like M.R. James's ghost stories, where we don't, you know, it's not sort of full-on horror, it's not kind of big pyrotechnic stuff, it's this very odd little details, we sort of glimpse things or we half hear something. It's the ordinary world with something odd going on in it, which makes us question, then, I suppose, the rest of the world altogether.
Now, we're used to subversions, postmodern subversions of generic literature, but you play it very straight, don't you? Even to the extent you have your sort of something horrible was happening in the other house at the end of chapter. So you do the tricks.
Yeah, I was very happy to take on the ghost story genre in this novel. I'm always interested in genre and what you can do within it while you're still staying inside it. You know, in the past, I've always enjoyed taking on the historical novel genre or the Victorian novel genre and making them tell distinctly lesbian stories, you know, stories they wouldn't tell in their own day. And with The Little Stranger, a big motivation for me was the stuff I'd been reading about class in the 40s. I'd finished The Night Watch with a sense of how the Second World War had really shaken up the class system in Britain, to the extent that I think middle and upper middle class people were really quite frantic. With the Labour government had come in, there were houses literally crumbling away because they couldn't get servants anymore to maintain them. That's exactly the situation with Hundreds Hall in
this
novel.
And of course it's just before the National Health Service.
So it's a time of great change and a very exciting time in lots of ways, but for, you know, conservative people it was a frightening time, and it was that fear that I kept coming across in novels and diaries at the time, you know, the upper middle class is in peril. And so that was my starting point, really. I thought, well, maybe if I just push this a bit further I can make it a full-blown story of the supernatural in which this upper middle class family really are in peril, you know, if there's something malicious at loose in their house. So I was happy to take on the genre, but hopefully, you know, make it tell a slightly different story from the stories we're used to hearing it tell.
I was quite surprised, because in your earlier novels, often the characters are quite glamorous or the situations are quite edgy and glamorous. And here the people are actually people who've been left behind, or they're middle-aged, they're injured, they are not what they used to be.
Yes, that's true. And that's something that's happened to my writing since I moved to the 40s, because I think you could say similar things about The Night Watch. You know, that was very much a novel about characters who were stuck, characters who'd been damaged by the emotional journeys they'd been through during the war, just as the city had been damaged. And they were, you know, in recovery, but not yet able to move on. And The Little Stranger, too, is about people who are in thrall to the past or can't adapt to a world, don't want to adapt to a world that they don't like the look of. So maybe it's something I've sort of imbibed from the 40s, because I certainly, when I was writing novels set in the 19th century, one of the things I enjoyed about that was capturing that Victorian exuberance that you find in those long, sprawling, complicated novels of Dickens and Wilkie Collins. You know, they're fantastic. But the fiction of the 40s, which I very much allowed to influence The Night Watch and The Little Stranger, is much quieter and it's pretty jaded. You know, think of Graham Greene, Patrick Hamilton. There's a kind of literal and moral grubbiness to the world that for now I've been quite happy to take on and exploit, I suppose.
But one thing your fiction has taught us is we cannot know what to expect next. It is a sort of an ongoing tale of the unexpected. Presumably you've pretty much done and dusted the 40s. Where are you going next?
Well, yes, it's funny. I mean, I feel like I could stay in the 40s for a long time, just as I felt I could stay in the Victorian period for a long time. I feel very attached to both eras and still feel there are lots of other stories to tell about them. But I do feel, I suppose, it would be nice to move on. I do like to take on slightly new ground with each book. So I'm kind of thinking I might go back a bit, not as far as the Victorians, but say to the 20s or the 30s, to the pre-war period. Now, I feel like I know the war and the post-war period very well, but I don't know much about the culture that led up to it. So I might be interesting to look at that for a while.
Well, there's something to look forward to. Meanwhile, thank you very much, and I hope you have a good time at Hay.
Thank you, I'm sure I will.
My name is Clive James, and you're listening to The Guardian's Haycast. The character that influenced me most was undoubtedly Hamlet. I hadn't read the book, as it were. I hadn't read the play. I saw the movie with Laurence Olivier when I was quite young, still in short pants. And I wanted to talk like that, and look like that, and sword fight like that, and even die like that.
Hello, I'm John Crace, author of The Guardian's weekly digested reads. And you know me, I hate to stereotype anyone, but it's Hay, so why not? Anyway, I've divided the, what do we reckon, 5,000, 10,000 people here this week into five main groups. And first up, we've got the local. And look, over there, there's one just wandering in to the Barclays Wealth Pavilion. He's wearing green wellies and a crispy, neat cagoule. And he's ostentatiously walking in just after the main speaker has started. There's no mistaking who's boss round here. There he is again. He's moaning about the cost of the tickets and grumbling that the whole event has been taken over by Ponzi media tarts from London. And I bet, in that grubby, nasty little plastic Summerfield bag that he's holding, that he's got some roughly hewn corned beef sandwiches that he's going to eat in the car park over lunch so that he can watch the Audis and the Volvos getting stuck in the mud. But for the moment, it's actually mud-free here. I don't suppose that'll last long, but it's probably not going to be much sport for Giles in the car park, but I can see him squinting up at the hills, and yep, he's declaring a storm coming in 15 minutes.
So Charlotte, Desmond Tutu, he's an anti-apartheid activist, a Nobel Peace Prize winner, no stranger to controversy, but he hasn't actually written a book. So what's he doing at the Hay Literary Festival?
Well, I suppose one of the things about the Hay Literary Festival is that it's a great celebration of the word in all its forms. And of course, Desmond Tutu, as a proponent of the spoken word, has been incredibly powerful as a humanitarian.
Well, let's hear now from our columnist Gary Young, who spoke to him in New York just before he set off for the green fields of Hay.
A while back, and a number of times, you said that you were winding down, that you were going to lead a more contemplative life and stop racing around. Here you are in New York. You're on your way to Hay. I'm wondering whatever happened to that.
I'm wondering as well. In many ways, I think when you are Nobel Peace Laureate, you, I think, have an obligation to humankind, to society. And with a world that faces so much conflict and suffering, there seems to be a place for those who just might help us change tech. But I am still deeply longing for a quiet life. And I really mean it when I say I'm really going to try. My wife says, of course, she's heard me say that several times. But I'm going to try next year and be ruthless. But you see, what do you do when the Prime Minister of, say, Solomon Islands writes and says, please, can you come and be with us when we launch our Truth and Reconciliation Commission? It seems so mean, so hard-hearted in a way to say no.
You've also said that you love to be loved, and that is a, I'm imagining that can be a problem, and it's not always obvious to the outsider that you love to be loved, because you keep saying things that get you in so much trouble.
I think most of us would tend to say that they prefer if they are popular than if they are unpopular. But I know for myself that it has tended to be a weakness, the weakness that wants to enjoy the limelight, a weakness that would frequently want to make you soften perhaps things that are hard that you need to say. Many people would be surprised if I said to them that, in fact, I am quite shy, you know. Doesn't look like it yet. Yeah. Look at your smile. I mean, I think, yes, you reckon, what? But in fact, I'm not quite as ebullient. And one of the weaknesses of that, when you link it with the wanting to be loved, would be that you hate being confrontational. One has had to be confrontational, and that is contrary to my temperament.
In South Africa, back home, you've managed at different times pretty much to get into a tussle with everybody there, including Nelson Mandela, Thabo Mbeki. I just want to read you something you said about Jacob Zuma. You know what's coming, don't you? You said, I pray that someone will be able to counsel him that the most dignified, selfless thing, the best thing he could do for a land he loves deeply, is to declare his decision not to take further part in a succession race for his party. Mm. Clearly that didn't happen. So how do you feel about that now?
I think, I mean, that many have felt uneasy about the fact that he had these charges hanging over his head. And I think it is still unfortunate that the way they were dealt with was not through a court, but as it were, administratively. And so there will always be this shadow hanging over him. And that's a shame. Mm-hmm. He's been elected by people to be our president. He is hugely popular with a large section of our community. And so the thing to do is to say, let us wait and see. Let us give him the chance to prove himself, hoping against hope that what we might have feared will not, in fact, eventuate.
I, for one, would not be able to hold my head high if a person with such supporters were to become my president. Is your head high now?
It's water under the bridge, and we've got this new reality. Let's see what happens. At this stage, I'm perhaps neutral.
That doesn't happen very often with you, does it? You said there that you hope against hope, which suggests that you're not very hopeful, or maybe not as hopeful as you might be.
No. I mean, it's just being realistic. It's saying we're facing very serious problems. I mean, like the rest of the world, we're facing the economic downturn, but we've also got problems that are peculiar to us. There's a very high incidence of HIV and AIDS. We are the epicenter, really, in many ways. We have high levels of crime, levels of poverty that are unacceptable, and unemployment. And then the usual bang shoot of corruption. And so they have a very full plate.
At different moments in history, different things have become the focal point for attention, nationhood or race or tribe. And it feels in this period that religion has become a focal point. Mm. You've devoted your life to religion, and I'm wondering whether you think that's true, and if so, why do you think that has happened?
Well, if you are saying that we are at a period when sometimes people have seemed to use religion to justify whatever. I mean, especially acts of terrorism. And so given a great deal of credence to religious intolerance, then you have to say, yes, accept that religion isn't what we imagine it to be. The fact of the matter is that a group that Kofi Annan set up came to agree. It was not the faiths that were a problem. It was the faithful.
Well, Charlotte, I'll let you escape now to the real business of watching some events. You'll be running around site taking in as much as possible for your daily diary, won't you?
I certainly will, Claire. I've got events starting at 9 o'clock every day and going all the way through the day. I'm just not sure when I'm going to eat or sleep, but I'm really looking forward to it.
That's it for today's Haycast. Tomorrow we'll be back with Giles Foden, author of The Last King of Scotland, who's introducing his new novel Turbulence, and Nicola Stern, who'll be telling us why we should be feeling upbeat about climate change. Today's programme was produced by Lucy Greenwell and Francesca Panetta. I'm Claire Armistead, and I'll be back with you tomorrow.